I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Last night, the head of the General Services Administration gave the green light for the transition to begin, declaring Joe Biden the, quote, apparent winner of the presidential race. Michigan certified Biden's win last night, while Pennsylvania is still finalizing votes, and the Trump legal team is promising to fight certification in court. President Trump's attempts to invalidate the results of the presidential election hit a major roadblock in Pennsylvania on Saturday night. Federal Judge Matthew Brand dismissed a campaign lawsuit charging widespread irregularities involving mail-in ballots. In a scathing opinion, he called the allegations unhinged and the case, quote, Frankenstein's monster. A bit later in the show, is this how a democracy is supposed to work? Joining us now is WHYY's Ryan Briggs. We'll be talking about where things stand in Pennsylvania. And Ryan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, any questions or comments as we talk about Pennsylvania, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Ryan, the certification deadline for Pennsylvania was yesterday. What's the holdup? How many counties have not issued their results?
Well, this, you know, is kind of changing hour to hour and day to day here. I think the last time I checked, there were four counties that had said that they were behind in certification. That's not necessarily unusual per se. I think most of them had cited minor issues in the delay. I think the outlier is Westmoreland County in western Pennsylvania said that they may not have their results ready until next week.
Do we know what the holdup is?
For Westmoreland specifically, I don't. In general, it tends to just be procedural issues. You know, these are all a function of these county boards of elections. They've got limited staff sometimes. Sometimes they have to go through, you know, individual ballots, provisional ballots, things of that nature. It's going to be different from county to county. But again, you know, this happens pretty much every election, so it's not that unusual. It's just that there's a lot more public interest in certification now.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, you know, 4, 8, 12, 16 years ago, we didn't really talk much about certification process. It didn't really make the news. But obviously, this year, as every vote gets either challenged or counted, every piece of this process now is out in the public.
Yeah, I mean, you can see, though, that for the vast majority of the state, I mean, again, there's 67 counties in Pennsylvania, and we're talking about maybe four that have, you know, some technical snags that are delaying certification. I mean, this is really the counties, you know, just kind of checking the work, signing off on the work that they've been doing for the last couple of weeks. And the only reason that I think it is so in the public eye is because of these legal challenges, you know,
sure,
that have sort of brought up the certification issue as potentially another sticking point for this election process that just feels to many people, I think, that it just keeps dragging on and on, you know, without a decisive end. So you're seeing a lot more interest than normal.
Sure, sure, which we'll be talking about with our guests who will join us later. How about the votes in Pennsylvania and even the suburbs around, the votes in Philadelphia and the suburbs around the city? What do we know about the certification of the votes there?
Southeastern Pennsylvania is pretty much done. Philadelphia and its collar counties, which are among, you know, the most populous in the entire state, finished without too many snags. I think in Montgomery and maybe one other county, you saw some party line splits in the actual vote to certify the county election results. So in Montgomery, there's a single Republican county commissioner who has to vote to essentially verify their election totals. And you saw a protest vote in that county, which was mirrored in some other parts of the state. Republicans siding with some of the talk from the Trump campaign about uncertainty, right? The possibility that there were irregularities or even some kind of fraud in the actual counting of votes. And so you saw some instances where you had dissent and people saying, I'm voting not to. I'm going to oppose the certification process on the grounds that there might be, you know, these irregularities that haven't been fully investigated yet. But that ultimately didn't stop any of the local counties from actually certifying.
You reported this morning in Philadelphia 743,966 votes were cast. Obviously, most of them for Biden, a little bit more than 130,000 for Trump. Was that a bigger turnout in 2020 than 2016, Ryan? Do we know?
Yeah, it was a bigger turnout, although I think that some people, Democrats, were looking for Philly to be, you know, this big engine that would produce even greater turnout as a kind of decisive referendum on the Trump administration. And I don't know if you really saw that. It was you know, historic turnout for sure. But was it so much, you know, that Philadelphia alone was going to decide the state? Not really. I don't know if that was ever realistic for people to expect that. And you also saw Republicans make some gains. But this is all in the context of a county that is, you know, very Democratic. It's like a 7-to-1 voter registration advantage, Democrats to Republicans. And, you know, you saw good turnout, high levels of turnout based on prior elections. And, you know, I think there's probably a ceiling on how much you could ever, you know, get in Philadelphia.
But it does look like Trump gained more votes between 2016 and 2020. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right. So there was a little shift, again, not enough to actually, like, throw the county towards Trump, but there were gains in some parts of the city. Trump's message obviously resonated in, you know, with voters in some areas where it hadn't in 2016. And the Republicans were able to make some, you know, marginal gains this year in Philadelphia. And so that, I think that had some people, you know, a little worried. What does that mean? That it seems like you could see a pattern of Republicans making inroads in these urban areas where they hadn't before. The larger picture, though, is that, you know, that's all weighted against these suburban areas like Montgomery County that, you know, just saw areas turn out for Biden in really unprecedented numbers, even compared to 2016. And so, you know, for the amount of progress that Republicans made in the city, you saw erosion of Republican gains in the suburbs in these areas that are also still, you know, quite populous and have a lot of votes, and, you know, we're able to swing the state as a whole, and, you know, to Biden.
There are still a number of legal challenges, but interestingly, last night the Pennsylvania Supreme Court issued a ruling. What was that in response to?
So there's essentially two big suits that are trying to challenge, you know, all of the results in the state. But then there's a series of smaller county level claims that were disputing individual ballots and trying to have certain individual votes thrown out on the basis of mostly, you know, technical issues, missing signatures or dates on these mail-in envelopes. They were perhaps unsurprisingly, you know, focused in places like Allegheny County, which is where Pittsburgh is, and Philadelphia, which are areas that, you know, went more strongly for Biden, have a lot of Democratic votes, saw a lot of mail-in voting. And so the campaign or supporters filed challenges over specific ballots. And some of the technical issues, you know, were upheld by lower courts who said, yeah, don't count these votes. They're too flawed. But that was reversed by the PA Supreme Court. And so there were about 8,000 votes, I think, in Philadelphia, and then another 2,000 in Allegheny County. I might have those numbers backwards, but you're talking around 10,000 votes total that, you know, will be included in the final tally now. So that was another, you know, of this sort of string of legal defeats that the campaign has experienced over the past couple of weeks. Every time they get a small victory here, it seems like it, you know, gets reversed on appeal. And that's been a pattern for a while.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, what the Supreme Court seemed to be ruling on was that the ballots that didn't have, you know, the perfect outer envelope would still be considered legal, correct?
Yeah, and it's that's the ultimate outcome here. It's also, I think, important to keep in mind that although in public, the campaign has talked a lot about these still unproven allegations of voter fraud in court when it comes down to these specific ballots, what they're challenging on are mostly these technical issues, right? They're not saying that this ballot was cast fraudulently or that there's evidence of this. They're saying, well, this was missing a signature, this date, things that are mistakes that you would expect to see maybe in any election. Somebody forgets to put their ballot in an envelope is not automatically evidence of voter fraud. It could just be a voter that made a mistake.
Is there, though, a suit or at least an effort by the Trump campaign to at least issue some kind of a temporary halt on the certification process, or is that going to be undone?
Yeah, I mean, there are these two outstanding federal suits that I alluded to earlier. They are pending, and one filed by the Trump campaign does seek a temporary restraining order to prevent certification. I think in general, they are viewed by legal analysts of all stripes as sort of a long shot. The ultimate remedy that the Trump suit is seeking is to eventually toss out, a million votes in the state. And this is also, the second go round here for this particular suit. I mean, it's been amended by the campaign. They've made changes to it, but they're still sort of heading in the same direction, which is that there's just so many questions around this election that they need the court to block certification and then jettison a huge number of votes. And you've seen jurists up and down, the court system as the campaign has gone on this journey that have said consistently that doesn't seem like something that's appropriate for any court to do.
On the heels of Judge Brand's decision Saturday night, I mean, when you read some of the language in that decision, he really took down their arguments for tossing votes.
Yeah, I mean, it's not unprecedented hardly to see a case thrown out with prejudice, but what the judge was essentially saying in his decision, this is sort of the first try the campaign had here with a case to throw out, a million votes or something. The judge in that case said that, the way that the suit had been brought was just so flawed that he was kind of, almost stopping just short of sanctioning the actual campaign and its lawyers and just saying, this is a total misread of the law, and the way that the suit was brought was just flawed up and down. And so it was a rebuke from a district judge, and the campaign of course immediately appealed that decision. That's where we are now, is in right. The appeal of that decision. But that is a bad start for an appeal. You generally don't want to come into a higher court saying, look, the judge that looked at this case made an error and here is what he said, and it's a rebuke of the campaign. It's not a great start.
Not a great start. Ryan Briggs, we're going to leave it there. Thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. That's WHYY's Ryan Briggs. We've got a lot more to talk about after this very short break. Is this how a democracy is supposed to work? And the GOP response to President Trump's actions, what that says about the Republican Party. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. 3 weeks after Election Day, it is official. The head of the GSA declared last night Joe Biden the apparent winner of the presidential race, allowing the transition to go forward. President Trump tweeted, "We will keep up the good fight side, and I believe we will prevail. His legal team has failed in their efforts to overturn the election, unable to prove widespread voter fraud in court. As mentioned earlier, a federal judge in Pennsylvania dismissed a Trump campaign lawsuit to invalidate the results of the presidential election in a scathing opinion, calling the strained legal arguments without merit. He went on to write in the USA, in the USA, this cannot justify the disenfranchisement of a single vote, let alone all the voters of its sixth most populous state. Our people, law, and institutions demand more, unquote. Today, Trump's failing efforts to overturn the presidential election, its impact on our country, and what it says about the state of our government. And joining us by Skype is Claire Finkelstein. She's professor of law and philosophy and faculty director, Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania's Law School. Claire Finkelstein, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Glad to be back.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, again, we want to hear from you. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Claire, before the GSA ruled last night, I had a totally different beginning for our show today. I was going to talk to you about whether we were in the middle of some kind of a coup. My question really to get us started is, did the system work? I mean, it was a ugly. It reflected poorly, I think, on our country. And there were many failed attempts to try to undermine the vote. But in the end, did the system hold?
It looks to me like it really did, Marty. And one of the things that's so important to remember here is that the Trump campaign is proceeding by using the court system. And that is part of our democracy. That is a critical way that we sort out disputes in a society governed by the rule of law. So though we may feel that the last 4 years have been an incredible assault on the rule of law in so many ways, and the fear that Donald Trump, no matter what happened, was not going to release his hold on the White House easily, the images of him clinging to the furniture and being dragged out by Secret Service, that may yet happen. But it's critical to remember that here the Trump campaign is proceeding by the court system, however misguided these lawsuits have been, and seems to be accepting the results of that system. They're still hoping for vindication by that method, but it is a use of our system that we're seeing before us, and that's delivering clear results.
Let me get Mickey Edwards in on our conversation, former Republican congressman from Oklahoma, also former chairman of the American Conservative Union. And Mickey Edwards, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah. Yeah. Hi. Thanks, Marty.
You're very welcome. I was talking with Claire Finkelstein about the fact that as of last night, with the GSA basically declaring the quote-unquote apparent winner, looks like we're in a new phase of this election of 2020. What do you make of this moment that we're in?
Well, we're in a new phase finally because a lot of business leaders, a lot of Republicans have begun to speak out in a way that Trump could not ignore, but I don't know how many things have completely changed. So we look at what's happening in the race in Georgia and the campaigns that are being run by the Democrats down there. We still have a problem that the great majority of Republicans in Congress have either supported what the president has been doing or been silent about it. And so I don't think our moment of jeopardy for democracy is completely past us, but I think that it's a good thing. I think the most impressive thing is that when these cases went to the courts, including courts that had Republican-appointed judges, they stood with the law, and they did not as Trump expected, just side with him because they were of the same party. So I think that was one of the bright sides, so that every one of these cases was getting tossed out, and they should have been.
Well, I'm picking it, and that's something actually that Claire Finkelstein was also saying as well. I want to quote something from Chris Christie, who was very critical of Trump's legal team over the weekend, making, you know, essentially false and in many cases outlandish claims in news conferences, but unable to make that same argument in court. I mean, the court, the judges, the justices threw out so many of those arguments. And just to get you to respond to that, Claire, I mean, what we can all say stuff in public, but when you're in a court of law, you need facts, right?
Well, that's right.
You need evidence.
And this has been an incredible display of incompetent lawyering. With the way they have proceeded in this legal case, it has been sort of shockingly bad. And if the president understood more clearly the way the legal system works, he would have fired his whole legal team and started again. You know, there is a basic requirement of competence for lawyers. And unfortunately, Rudy Giuliani really has not displayed that. But as you're also pointing to, the gap between what, for example, Giuliani or other members of the legal team say in press conferences and what they're able to say in court is really quite striking. And that raises some ethical questions about these press conferences, because a lawyer should not be telling lies or giving false information, even outside a courtroom, when they are in the middle of a pending case. It's just a violation of lawyers' ethics. And so, this has been a display of both incompetent and unethical lawyering that we really should take a hard look at.
I want to pick up on that, but Mickey Edwards, let me get you back in. And I was thinking, you know, if you truly believe that there was widespread fraud and that you had won an election, a tight race, would you hire Rudy Giuliani to defend you, or Sidney Powell, or the team that, you know, had a lot of insane press conferences, but also were unable to make those arguments in court?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't hire Rudy for anything. But, this is I think it's a bit of a mistake to look at what was happening here in the context of legal norms, judicial norms, lawyering responsibilities. That's not been the way of this administration, and I don't think it's the way of the lawyers he's hired. I think this was more the way it would be done in a dictatorship, where you go in and you basically signal to the judges what it is you want their outcome to be, and expect them to deliberate. So, Giuliani was honest, at least in saying, you know, when he brought a fraud case, telling the judges, well, no, this is not about fraud. So that was a pretty honest statement. So, our court system, I think, has made us proud in these last couple of weeks, but I also think it signals how much what the Trump administration was trying to do really had nothing to do with normal legal practice. It really had a way trying to bully people who they thought were on their side into just saying, we're going to let you stay in office.
Claire, I mean, this was a campaign where the president and his supporters would chant about locking up opponents. It happened in 2016, also happened in 2020. But do you think in the final analysis that what Trump is trying to do is to poison the environment for Joe Biden, to spread mistrust and confusion about the election and the results?
Well, that's an excellent question, especially because when you look at so many of these lawsuits, they could not have changed the results. And they know that. The Trump campaign knows full well that challenging slightly more than 8,000 absentee ballots in Philadelphia, even if the case went their way, wouldn't make a dent in Philadelphia's outcome, let alone Pennsylvania or the country. And even all of the lawsuits combined wouldn't do that. So that really raises the question, what are they doing by bringing these lawsuits? Are they trying to poison the environment for the Biden administration? Are they trying to rile up their base Are they trying to help gain support for the Georgia runoff by continuing to make a lot of noise about this? Or is it just that Donald Trump irrationally cannot bring himself to stop fighting and to stop conceding? I think this will always be one of the mysteries. An even greater mystery is why members of the Senate, like Lindsey Graham, have been willing to lend themselves and to, in effect, really destroy their reputation and their integrity by phoning up the Secretary of State of Georgia and trying to get him to throw out ballots, absentee ballots in Georgia to influence the results of the election there. Why Republicans in the House and particularly the Senate have been willing to lend themselves to these efforts to block the peaceful transition of power is even more baffling.
Well, and I should say to our listeners that you and several others have called for a Senate Ethics Committee to investigate Lindsey Graham, whether he violated some of the chamber's rules. So I just want to make sure our listeners know that. I also want to hear
correct.
From you.
I filed a complaint with Walter Schaub and Richard Painter with the Senate Ethics Committee to investigate Senator Graham's behavior on this.
That's Claire Finkelstein, and she's head of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Also with us, Mickey Edwards. He served, 16 years in the House as a Republican, Mickey Edwards?
That was 16 years when the House was very different and when the Republican Party was very different, but yes.
And we are talking about sort of where things stand in the 2020 election. You probably know by now that the GSA did declare last night that Joe Biden was the, quote, apparent winner of the presidential race. This allows that transition to go forward. The president did tweet that he was going to keep up the fight, and he believes that he will prevail. Again, you can join us. We got a lot of people that want to weigh in on this. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Mickey Edwards, can you understand, I mean, basically what Claire was saying about Senator Lindsey Graham, and I'm thinking of others who, you know, whose reputations are frankly on the line, about the Republican Party's unwillingness to put daylight between themselves, itself, I guess, and President Trump. There are a couple of people that have spoken out, but we're not hearing from Mitch McConnell and others as well about what Trump has done to the party and to the country.
Well, I think there are two different factors here. One of them is that the longer and the more they can sustain the idea that Biden's election was illegitimate, or put the other way, that Trump's defeat was illegitimate, the easier it's going to be to continue to do what was done with Merrick Garland, basically to just be an obstacle, saying we don't have to cooperate with an illegitimate government. But the other part of it is, Donald Trump poses a danger for reelection still to some of these people. The most recent example is where he has suggested now maybe it's time for somebody to run in a primary against Governor Mike DeWine in Ohio. That you still have a lot of cowardice going on among Republicans who know that in our political party system, which, by the way, I think is a terrible system, as you know, a party primary can end your career, and Donald Trump has a lot of weight still in Republican primaries. And so some of it is calculation about tax bills or other kind of laws, but a lot of it is just trying to preserve, you know, their positions in Congress without getting knocked off in a primary. It's cowardice.
I mean, survival. It's about survival, Mickey Edwards.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. But you know, I use the word cowardice because, you know, people have given their lives to fight for this country and, faced machine guns and cannon, you know, whatever had to do to protect America. And these people are afraid of losing an election. Well, you know, you can go on and have a life after you've lost an election. There are some things that you need to do to prove who you are, and going along with the kinds of things they've been required to go along with in this administration, you know, are permanently damaging to their reputations. I don't know how any of these are going to look good 20 years from now, 30 years from now, when we look back and say, you know, how did these people behave in this time of crisis?
Let me read a couple of comments and get some callers to join us. Stephen says this is what democracy looks like, slow and tedious. A comment from Trip, from Chip. Trump's superpower of having no shame will continue to be effective for most of the Republican base, who will see him as a president in exile. A comment from Nina. With these unproven allegations about voter fraud, can the lawyers with these frivolous lawsuits be disbarred? We'll get to that, but let me just get a caller. This is Keith from South Jersey. And Keith, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning, Marty.
Morning.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I want to do a quick quote from one of the Batman movies in which the Joker was described not as somebody hungry for power, for money, for revenge. Some people just like watching the world burn. Hmm. Whether or not you want to ascribe this to Trump in particular and how he's handling things, what about the 70 million plus people who indeed voted for him? Sure. You can't call them all anarchists in some fashion, but how many of those people do your guests think are really interested in improving the country, but how many are just content to watch things crumble?
Well, it's an interesting question. Claire, we're almost up on a break here, but let me give you a chance to respond. And I mean, it should be said that, you know, 70 million people did vote for Donald Trump for re-election.
I'm very concerned about the tendency to blame Trump voters. Of course, I don't agree with them. And I think that the country set itself on a terrible course by voting in Donald Trump 4 years ago. But I do think there's been an incredible disinformation campaign that has been conducted both originally by foreign powers and Russia's interference in the original 2016 election, but also now by domestic forces. And I think the degree to which this administration, as well as Republicans in the House and Senate, have been willing to embrace false narratives has really had an incredibly damaging impact on the degree to which people are able to inform themselves and think through issues of democratic governance, and had a very, very bad impact on our basic institutions. I think the Senate is at this point a badly broken institution. The whole idea of the Senate and the House being a check and balance on the executive branch has been largely weakened and has decayed in the last 4 years. So we're going to have to work very hard to build back up our basic institutions, and hopefully that will have an impact on what people can understand about where their interests lie.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Claire Finkelstein and Mickey Edwards. We're talking about, yes, the race for the White House. The GSA called the winner, in the kind of language of the GSA, calling Joe Biden the apparent winner of the presidential race. That does allow the transition to go forward, but lots of unanswered questions. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Claire Finkelstein. She's a professor of law and philosophy, faculty director, Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Also with us is Mickey Edwards, a Republican, served 16 years in the House of Representatives representing Oklahoma, former chair of the American Conservative Union. And Mickey, do you still teach at Princeton University?
I'm a visiting professor there now. I used to be regular faculty, but then I took a diversion to go to Washington with the Aspen Institute back at Princeton again.
Fair enough. Let me just pick up on what Claire was talking about before the break about the fact that we've got 70 million people who voted for Trump. And certainly in 2016, a number of Democrats who voted for Hillary Clinton, you know, talked about foreign interference. Now we're talking about, you know, domestic interference. Do you see any ways to compare and contrast 2016 and 2020 when it comes to the critics of the winner of the presidential race?
Well, look, first, I agree with Claire that I think that it's a little too easy to just point the blame at the people who voted for Donald Trump. They had a lot of different reasons, some that were explored after the 2016 election about the fact that there are, you know, the benefits of globalization and some of the changes in American economic life have not equally benefited everybody. There are people out in the heartland who really do have legitimate grievances about the way they have fared recently. There was a reaction. This did not happen in 2016, but since there was some reaction here where people this year were not voting for Donald Trump, but they were voting against the alternative, the fear of the left, which was a very effective strategy by Donald Trump. I'm from Oklahoma, and so I don't believe that we have 70 million people who are stupid or bigots.
Right.
It's a little more complicated than that. And I think one thing going forward is we have to try to better understand what it was that could have caused normal, sane, rational people to cast a vote for Donald Trump, and try to make sure we see that their concerns and grievances are addressed so this doesn't happen again.
Let me get a caller. This would be Mike from Germantown. I see him on my list here. So we're going to go to Mike from Germantown, and he's got a comment for you, Claire. And Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
As I talk to your interviewer, I'm center right. And I love people who are center left because we share the center and we can talk to each other. Mm-hmm. But Claire, I got to tell you, your remark was a bit insulting. I mean, you basically, maybe I'm overreacting, but it seems like you suggested that that there's no basis for us believing what we believe, that we're too dumb to know what's good for us. That's number one. Or that we're subject to some foreign disinformation program. I don't know that you meant to do that, but it doesn't even sound like you even want to understand, you know, our point of view or how we arrive, at the approaches that we do. And I love the fact that we're in Pennsylvania. You know, the people, the Democrats in the center part of the state are fiscally conservative, family value. They're just like Republicans. That's why we're a purple state and not a red or blue state.
Fair enough.
I'm one of those purple people. I'm a purple people.
Okay. Center You're purple right. people.
And yeah, so perhaps you might want to rethink about how that remark came across to my ears.
Sure.
Because if we're going to discuss this, if we're going to discuss this kind of thing, we can't start with, if you don't agree with me, then you're wrong. I mean, that's silly, right?
Mike, let me give Claire a chance to respond, because this is important.
Well, Mike, let me thank you for your comment. And I think there's some fairness to it. However, in the beginning, I said, I don't think we should begin by blaming Trump voters. Now, I believe that what Donald Trump has both done in his leadership of the country and inspired in others has been profoundly damaging, both of our basic institutions and of the interests of individuals like you and me. So I don't think that he has furthered the goals that might have led you or others to vote for him in the first place. And that's why I maintain that there is a certain amount of disinformation here. I think there has been false, real detachment from truth. We know that Donald Trump has not been honest, that he continually tells lies, and that the elected representatives who support him have colluded in those lies. So I don't know how to understand why voters would vote so much against their own interests, and why they would, people who I agree with Mickey are not fundamentally bigoted, would be attracted by a language of racism and division. And I think that's been one of the most serious pieces of damage that Donald Trump has brought to the country, which is a real polarization of individuals who might otherwise, as you point out, Mike, get along very well, because here in Pennsylvania, you know, we're very purple.
That's
so,
right, we are.
It's not an insult to you. It's more a puzzlement on my part. I do seek to understand, and I would very much like to understand. I think we're going to have to try to understand going forward in the next 4 years to try to heal some of those divisions.
Mike, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Here's a comment from Stu. Mickey, I'll put this to you. Our democracy is not damaged by Trump's lawsuits. The damage is caused over 40 years of Republican Party working to undermine the ideals of our country. Do you see it that way?
Well, you know, what the ideals are that are being pursued, you know, will look differently to a Republican or a Democrat, and there are arguments, you know, on both sides. So, I mean, I do think that we've done great harm by ignoring George Washington and going ahead and creating a political party system that automatically divides us into Team A and Team B, because the fact is that there's a lot of room that where Democrats and Republicans can find agreement if they just sit down and say, you know, it's not my policy or your policy, but what's the problem we're trying to solve? And how can we talk about it together and figure out, you know, a common way to go forward? So, yeah, I think that there are a lot of things that my party, Republican Party, has done that I don't agree with. A lot of things Democrats have done that I don't agree with. And if you just start and have respect for both points of view and then sit down and say, but there's 320 million of us. We all live together in the same country. You know, how can we come up with a solution we can both live with? I think that's a better way to go ahead than saying, you know, the Republicans are evil and the Democrats are evil.
I get email from all the campaigns asking for money. It's a way, as a journalist, you can kind of keep track of what's going on in a sort of bizarre way. Anyway, I got this morning. Friend, did you hear the news? Rudy Giuliani and the Trump campaign legal team have reportedly uncovered mass amounts of voting irregularities, lots of capitals there. One thing that's become very clear in the fake news media is continuing to ignore the biggest political scam of all time, Contribute Now. Claire, how much of what's going on is about raising money?
Well, I mean, that's a really good question. Let me go back to the content first of the message you got. You see, this is the detachment from truth that really worries me, because the Trump legal team has not uncovered any systematic fraud. And indeed, Donald Trump's own Department of Homeland Security, the cyber division, has said this was the most secure election in the history of the country. So in that sense, the system worked. So why is it that message still inspires people to donate money? And it must be, or they wouldn't be running it. There is somehow an inability to close in on common facts that we have, to a degree that we have never seen before in this country. We cannot really rely on what our elected representatives say, and we don't get clear corrections in the media as well. So I think perhaps this is something that we all need to do some soul searching on, including the media. I think the pandemic, ironically, may be helping us to look harder at facts, because, you know, whatever people felt Donald Trump would do for them, I think it's become incredibly clear that his mismanagement of the pandemic, his refusal to look facts in the face and take the deliverances of science seriously, is literally killing hundreds of thousands of Americans. So, so there may be a return to facts, but whether or not we can sort of take the political dialogue and bring different sides together in a common assessment of both facts, law, and political values is what remains to be seen.
Let me get to Philip from Brewery Town to join our conversation. And Philip, thanks for your patience. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hello, hello, Marty. How's it going?
Can you get a little closer to your microphone?
Okay.
You're Philip, you there?
Yeah, sorry about that. You guys kind of came out of nowhere. My comment was about Sarah Murphy, the GSA, and that I do believe she was correctly doing her job, that her office does not have the constitutional authority to call the results of the election. And had she signed the letter prior to President Trump's approval, the Trump campaign would have sued on the basis that she didn't have the authority to do so, and most likely would have won that lawsuit. And seeing that the president's strategy to try to win the White House again for a second term is to try to create as much noise and loss of integrity in the election, I believe it was the right call to wait so that that lawsuit wasn't put into the quote-unquote win category for the president. I think it just would have caused too much noise for her to go ahead without the consent.
Fair enough. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And again, you can join the conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can give us a call, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Mickey Edwards, it's been a couple of years since you served in the House of Representatives. I mean, what has poisoned the environment there that there is so much partisanship and it seems ill will?
Well, Marty, you know, we've talked about this before. I mean, you know, it didn't start with this. I teach my classes at Princeton. I talk about the fact that when people get very upset about gerrymandering, which is a significant problem, and they will point to what's happening now in places like Wisconsin, done by the Republicans, I point out that Bill Burton did this in California in 1982, which is what allowed the Democrats to have significant victories, in the years after that. So, people look back at the time when I was in Congress and they say, well, those were the good days. Everybody got along. Well, the reason it looked that way is because every year I was in Congress, I was 16 years, Democrats had a huge margin, 100 more votes than Republicans did. So it was not bipartisanship. It was one party domination. And so it looks different. I think one of the things that has happened is that now the country has sorted. We've talked before, I think you and I, about the book Bill Bishop wrote, The Big Sort. People have divided where they live, so you don't really have very many purple states anymore. You also have a Congress where the numbers are almost evenly divided. If one party has a 100-vote margin, you know, it's going to look different than if it's almost tied, and the next election is going to determine who all the chairmen are and who decides what bills come up for a vote. So, we have to solve for that because you can't go back and say, why is it like the 60s and 70s? Because the country is different than it was in the 60s and 70s.
You know, Claire, I was thinking about when the I guess the rule of law was really working against President Nixon, Goldwater and some others literally went to the White House to tell him, look, it's time for you to go. Hugh Scott, I believe, was there, some others, saying that, you know, the it's time for you to leave the White House. Do you see that happening today?
No, we did not see that at all. And many of us sort of expected it. Indeed, Mitch McConnell immediately after November 7th seemed to say, OK, Donald Trump, you've lost. And he backtracked and others backtracked as well. And there was a kind of increase in the amount of support that the president received from members of the Senate in the immediate sort of aftermath of the election, that grew as the president put pressure on these individuals. And the question is, why has he had the hold on members of an independent branch of our federal government that once again was designed to serve as a check and balance on the executive branch? So that's something that we need to contend with moving forward. How do we shore up the independence of members of the legislature so that they can serve that function. Fortunately, the courts have shown themselves to be more robust with regard to the basic design of our democracy, and the court system is playing that role of an independent check. The judges are sticking to the law, are deciding and reasoning according to their conscience. And we might look at what is it about the court system that is able to remain more independent and more robust than our legislature.
Well, this just in, Governor Tom Wolf said just this moment today, the Pennsylvania Department of State certified the results of the November 3rd election in Pennsylvania for president and vice president of the United States as required by federal law. I've signed the certificate of ascertainment for the slate of electors for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. That just in. Claire Finkelstein and Mickey Edwards, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having us, Marty.
Thanks for joining us. And thanks, bye-bye. And thanks for you for your comments and your questions as well. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.